Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about water. I think it's safe to say that most people have no idea how much water they use in a single day. Now, if you added it all up, the water that you drink, that you use to wash with, that you use to flush the toilet, those kinds of routine uses, you add all that up, that actually comes to a pretty significant number. And of course, if you multiply that by the number of people in the world, that is definitely a significant number. However, our guest for this hour, Focus 580, science writer Fred Pierce, says you can't stop there. What you have to do is think about the water that goes into growing our food, that produces the fibers that we wear, that goes into making other things that we use. And then you come up with a number that is truly staggering. It could be, for an individual, hundreds of thousands of gallons a year. And the demand for water is growing. And he says that there is a real possibility that in the future we could see conflict in various places around the world over water. He is the author of a book that we'll be talking about in this hour of the show. The title is When the Rivers Run Dry, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. It's published by the Beacon Press, and certainly you could find it in the bookstore. Fred Pierce has been writing about water issues now for over 20 years. He's a former news editor at New Scientist. Currently, he's the environment and development consultant. He's also written for Audubon, Popular Science, Time, the Boston Globe, and Natural History. And he has a book that I do want to mention that's not out yet, but will be coming out next year, that has to do with global climate change. That book is titled With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change, and that's due out here in March of 2007. He's joining us by telephone from England, as a matter of fact. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. Any place else that you might be listening here over the air, Illinois and Indiana, or over the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Pierce, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Not at all.
I think we could start first with some numbers, and you give some of them in the book. And as I say, the numbers are truly staggering when you widen the frame and you go beyond simply talking about how much water we use for those things that come to mind right away, for cooking, for washing, for drinking, for flushing the toilet, all of that. Mm-hmm. But if you enlarge the frame, though, and you consider how the things that we use, how much water it takes to grow cotton for the clothes we wear and to grow the food that we eat. And then if you think about that on a per capita basis, that's when you get into these numbers, these truly amazing numbers of hundreds of thousands of gallons per person per year.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of the starting points for this. The whole book really was just the realization about how much water personally it takes to get me through the day. Now, as you said, you know, the water that we use in the home for drinking and flushing the toilet and having a shower and so on is maybe typically 40 gallons each for every one of us, something like that. Now, if you add in the water that we use around the home for, I don't know, swimming pools or doing outdoor water use, sprinkling the lawn, that kind of thing, we can get up to rather high numbers, sure, maybe 80 or 90 gallons, something like that. Not many households would go higher than that per person in the house. But when you start talking about, when you start talking about the water that's used to grow the food, you go a whole order of magnitude different. I mean, just to buy a bag of rice, if you buy a bag of rice from the store, then, if you like, bound up in that rice, the water used to grow that rice is about 100, 130 gallons for a pound of rice, similar amount for a pound of wheat, 65 gallons for a pound of potatoes. And when you get into meat and milk from cattle, when you obviously have to provide feed for the cattle first, the numbers get even higher. So for a quarter pound of hamburger, just a quarter pound of hamburger, you're talking about something like 3,000 gallons of water being used. For a gallon of milk, for a quart of milk, rather, you're talking about between 500 and 1,000 gallons of water. I mean, these are just huge amounts of water. I reckon, personally, that for me, and I would guess I'm fairly typical. I'm a meat eater, I'm a beer drinker, and so on. I reckon I get through about my own weight in water every day. Yeah. I mean, you know, these are just very, very, very high amounts of water. And over a year, it's probably, for me personally, it's something like half the size of an Olympic-sized swimming pool, something like that.
Yeah.
And it, as you say, if you add that up over to the billions of people on the planet, it's really no wonder that we're starting to hit problems with water. Many of our largest rivers are literally starting to run dry.
I think it's interesting that that you and apparently other people talk about the way that water is embodied in products, things that either are imported or exported as virtual water. And I think that that's an interesting way to think about it, because then you talk about the fact that there are countries now that are in effect either importing or exporting water, not the water,
yeah.
because that's a very difficult thing to do. But if
sure.
they import food, or if they export food, or say, you know, say they grow cotton and they're exporting that as a commodity, that takes a lot of water. So you're saying that, that you're encouraging people to think about this in terms of not just importing or exporting food or cotton, but importing or exporting water.
Yeah, economists start talking now about virtual water, by which they mean the water that you're importing, effectively importing, or somebody has used so that you can import water. I mean, that's very essential for some nations. For instance, Egypt in the Sahara Desert, with the Nile as the only source of water, effectively ran out of water to grow its own food something like 30 years ago. I guess it had two prospects there. It could have gone to war to get more water from somebody else, or it could start importing water in the form of food. And we can all be pleased that it did the latter. So many desert nations really do rely on importing virtual water to survive. But it's more pernicious, I think, sometimes when we're talking about countries with relatively good water supplies themselves, or with or with plenty of money to get by, who are, if you like, emptying the rivers of other nations. Certainly sitting in Europe, I think of how we buy in water, or we buy in cotton for our clothing, and we buy in sugar in large quantities from countries like Pakistan and India, which are desperately short of water and relying on one or two rivers which were already overdrawn. And those rivers are being overdrawn, rivers like the Indus in Pakistan, I'm thinking of that particularly, but also the Nile in Africa and others, where those rivers are literally being emptied to grow sugar, to grow cotton, and other products to supply to us in Europe, and no doubt in North America as well. And they don't get compensated really for that. The world market system doesn't really, it reflects the price of products in a rather narrow way, not the damage being done to natural resources by rivers along the way. So, you know, I mean, I think this new sort of geopolitical reality, we talk an awful lot about the politics of oil these days, quite rightly, but there's an emerging new politics about water as well.
I'm sure that some people might say, well, gosh, most of the earth is water. Is that something we really need to worry about? Then, of course, you have to say to them, well, yeah, but a lot of that is salt water. And a lot of the fresh water that exists actually is frozen. So then if you ask the question, well, okay, particularly if you're talking about fresh surface water in a usable form, how much is there? Is it actually possible to make an estimation of how much
there is? It is. I mean, these numbers are, they're couched in terms of cubic kilometers of water, or a cubic mile of water, if you prefer. I mean, so they're very... It's a very difficult notion to get your head around exactly how much water there is in a cubic mile of water. But those calculations can be done. They're a bit crude, but broadly they can be done. How much the water there is in the rivers at any one time, or how much water flows down the rivers in a year. And the calculation really is that, roughly speaking, now the world is using something like half of all the water that's available in the rivers we're getting through. The other thing that one can say about it is, yes, of course, but water is constantly recycled. We use water, we pour it perhaps in the form of sewage or sort of polluted irrigation water back into our rivers. The river water flows down to the sea, the water evaporates again and it forms clouds and it rains once again. And that's true. And water is one of the great renewable resource, if you like, thank heavens, because we're still relying on the water that we've used. You know, it's the same water as the dinosaurs drank that we drink. So it's constantly recycled by nature. But the problem is we're now using it on such a scale that we're finding that the water isn't where the people are and it isn't where it is when we need it. It's somewhere else. And the most vivid form of that, and hence the title for my book, is when we see that great rivers of the world, rivers that I certainly learnt about as a school student many years ago, as great rivers of the world, are, if you like, you know, they're fictions of our imagination almost now. Some of them exist on the map, they're in the atlases. There's a blue line where the Colorado is, and where the Rio Grande are, to say. But much of the year, these rivers essentially do not run. There is no water in the riverbanks. And I find that rather scary, personally, and I think probably people who live along those riverbanks and rely on that water find it rather more scary than I do. Mm.
We have a couple of callers here, and of course we'll continue to talk with our guest, Fred Pierce. He writes about the environment. He's been writing about water issues for a long time. He's former news editor at New Scientist and currently is its environment and development consultant. He's the author of a book about this very issue. The title is When the Rivers Run Dry. It's published by the Beacon Press. Questions are welcome. We have two people here ready, and we'd be happy to take others. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll go first to someone here local where we are in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'll just make a few comments and I'll go off the air. First, I think that down the road you ought to really consider this maybe for a documentary in terms of impact. I mean, when you get into it, I don't think people even, you know, fully realize, until, you know, your discussion. Next one is that conservation. I mean, we've not done a good job in conservation. A few other points. I guess I was sort of taken back on ethanol, that 5 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of, ethanol. And I'm thinking then if you add into it, in terms of the growing and all that kind of stuff, it really has a much greater impact than that. The other one is that in terms of crop, modified crops, it ends up that this way you can use more pesticides and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's my comments, and I'll go off the air.
All right. Well, let's take up the topic that the caller mentioned about conservation, because I think, you know, whenever we get into talking about water issues, some people say, well, if all of us did what we could to conserve water, we did all those things recommended, we got a toilet that uses the smallest amount as possible and a low flow shower head, and when we're standing there brushing our teeth, we don't just let the water run, you know, all those sorts of things. We don't water our grass. If all of us did that, would it matter very much?
Well, it would make a difference. It would especially make a difference locally. So in your city or community, it would make it a lot easier to supply the water. Many cities across the U.S. and else, and you're not alone in this, obviously, are pumping, because the rivers are running very low, you're pumping out underground water reserves. And many of those reserves, particularly in the more arid areas, are simply not recharging. There isn't enough rain falling. There isn't enough water getting through the soil down into the rocks underground to replace the water that's being pumped out. So in those circumstances, it's absolutely vital that communities conserve water so that they will still have, if you like, reserves of water for the future. Otherwise, you become increasingly reliant on large canal systems and distribution systems and pumps and so on from sometimes long distances, and if those long distances involve tapping into rivers that are also running dry, then you can get into very big trouble. So I think while many of the, it's certainly true that agriculture is around the world the biggest user of water by some way, roughly 3/4 of the water that we take out of the rivers and take from underground reserves around the world today is used for growing crops, food, but cotton and so on as well. And that raises the issue of ethanol, of course. So if we're starting to grow corn not to feed cattle or for foodstuffs generally, but are starting to grow it as a biofuel to pour into the tank, then that raises, various environmental studies are currently being done on whether this is a good thing to do, whether it's a good substitute for oil, or whether there are environmental knock-on effects. But I haven't seen any of that have looked seriously at the water implications of this, that if you, I mean, you know, quite a large areas of farmland are not very intensively cropped these days because we simply don't need the amount of crop that would grow. But if you have an extra new demand for corn from ethanol, then crop production could go up very significantly, and the demands for water to grow those crops could rise significantly. And that could have a, particularly in the American West, could have a major effect. It could be the last straw for many of our rivers, and quite often it will mean that certain groups of farmers will be able to get, will demand access to water, particularly upstream users. And farmers and communities downstream could find themselves ever more short of water. So it creates new stresses in the system. And as I say, there are stresses which have not really been looked at so far. We still, even environmentalists, I think, still regard water as an essentially unlimited and essentially free resource. And we don't give it the attention that we should do until we literally run out.
Well, for industrial users, whether we're talking about agriculture, and there I think it's true that irrigation would be the biggest. If you want to talk about industrial uses, irrigation would be the biggest. But it's also used in other kinds of manufacturing processes. Mm. It would be used in making ethanol. It would be used in, you know, who knows what, in making paper, in, you know, an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah.
If we got industrial users to use it, to do it in the way that was most efficient as possible, waste the smallest amount, recover what you can. You know, if that was a major, if we made that a major priority, would that make a big difference?
I think it would. It depends where you are, because in some parts of the country where there are already water shortages, manufacturers have realized the need to make savings, make economies in the way they use water, and they can make fantastic savings. In something like the paper and wood industry, or the paper and pulp industry, there are huge savings to be made if you simply recycle the water used in your processing. To use it again, just clean it up and use it again, clean it up and use it again, rather than just running through the system once. And there are huge savings that could be made there, and you know, sometimes are. To be fair, I mean, the U.S. Is a big consumer of water, but it's also quite a big recycler of water. So there are, some things are being done, but there is certainly much more that can be done. I would guess that one of the best ways of encouraging people to do that would have more effective water pricing. Really, we don't, in general, pay the full cost of water when we buy it, whether we buy it as domestic consumers or farmers or industrialists. Very few people really pay the full price of water. Most of the big water infrastructure projects are very often federal-funded or state-funded, and then, you know, the price of the water that we subsequently buy from those systems is not fully represented in the charges that are made against us. So I think proper pricing of water would go quite a long way to encouraging all sorts of people, from you and me, the consumer, to farmers, to industrialists, to save water, to recycle water, to just use water more intelligently. So I think that's a good way to go. We have to be careful that we don't cut off supplies from you know, people who are in desperate need of it, and who need, you know, there is a human right to a basic level of water, I think. But beyond that, I think pricing is an effective way of encouraging efficient use of water, and that's something which applies whether you're talking about Africa or the American Midwest. Mm.
We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, so we'll continue. Next, talking with someone in a community not all that far away from us here, Belgium. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I don't want to be argumentative, but I somewhat question some of the numbers you've thrown out, mm-hmm. because if I look at just our area here. Now, I have to admit that where we live here in East Central Illinois is very plentiful with water when we consider water. But I live along a river that has many tributaries that have other towns on it. And the water at the far end of the tributary falls as rain. The cows eat it. The corn's used it. Then the people up there pump it out as well water and put it into the river, and then it comes downstream to the first big town, and they pump it out of their river and use it for their own water, and they reclaim it and put it back in, and goes downriver a little bit farther to the Wabash, and there it's used for power generation and for wood pulping. So the water naturally is used many, many times. So when you say it takes 3,000 gallons for a half a pound of rice or whatever it was, I can't see that.
Well, it's a crude number. I mean, it gives you a sense of how much water is used. But as I said earlier, yes, water is recycled in many ways, either by being evaporated and brought back as rain, or it's reused along river systems. I mean, I live in London in the UK, and the water that comes out of my tap has gone through several other people along the way down the River Thames, which is not a very long river. It's just 200 or 300 miles. But it will have been drunk by people in towns all the way down that river, and that a typical glass of water will have been drunk 7 times as that water comes down the River Thames before it gets to me, and before it goes into the ocean and is evaporated and comes back again, no doubt. Water is constantly recycled, but the telling point is really when the rivers run dry. I mean, if you look at the River Colorado, for instance, where virtually no water now crosses the border into Mexico, and the Mexican farmers suffer as a result. If you look at the Rio Grande, where for about 200 miles downstream of El Paso, for much of the year, that river is empty. There is simply no water in the river until a tributary comes in from Mexico and partly refills it. Now, when that's happened, if there is no water in the river, there is no water in the river. The reason there is no water in that river is that it has all been taken out, put into reservoirs and distributed to farmers who, yes, irrigate their crops with it, and some of that water gets incorporated into the crops. Some of it evaporates from their fields. Some of it goes back to the river, absolutely. Some of it goes into underground reserves, where it may be pumped up again later by the farmers, but often becomes itself polluted with salt or other things. These things are intensely local. I mean, you're right that there are no absolute rules. That different things happen to water in different places. But the fact, the extent to which one can draw a global story is to say that there are quite a large number of major rivers in the world today which are running dry because people are taking all the water out. And when that happens, yes, the water does turn up somewhere else and somebody else will get a use of it. But if you're living on a river that's run dry, then you have a serious problem. And those problems are starting to get scaled up from being very local issues to regional issues. So we now have, say, a country like China, which can no longer feed itself, principally because there is not enough water, mainly in the north of the country, to grow the wheat in particular that they're used to growing, to feed 500 million people up in the northern half of the country. Or India, where the rivers don't provide so much water for much of the country now, but where they have relied increasingly in the last few years on pumping up underground reserves, but where the water tables are now falling very, very fast. I know that's a loss of, if you like, a water reserve, the underground water, and that certainly isn't being replaced by the rains or even by percolation from the farmers' fields themselves. So, yes, it's local, but we are getting local difficulties are beginning to turn into regional and, to some extent, a global problem.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Fred Pierce. He's been writing about water issues now for a couple of decades. He's former news editor at New Scientist and currently is its environment and development consultant. He's also written for other publications, including Audubon, Popular Science, Time, the Boston Globe, and Natural History. His book is When the Rivers Run Dry, the subtitle Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century, and it's published by the Beacon Press. Other callers here ready to go. Next, back locally here, and callers in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to go back to the issue of going to war over the water. And in fact, I think we're already seeing this. Perhaps you don't consider Israel and Palestine to be in a state of war, but I'm sure a lot of people in the region consider themselves to be at least very close to the state of war. And even though it doesn't get a lot of coverage in the U.S. media, a very major issue in the whole battle over where the borders of Israel should be established and where the physical barrier being built is going is in fact enclosing into the area that Israel is at least nominally claiming is a huge portion of the potable water in that area.
I agree, I think, with most of what you say. Yes, water is I've spent a little bit of time on the West Bank, and water is an absolutely critical issue, especially very locally. If you visit Palestinian villages, many of which are very close to Israeli settlements. Often the Palestinian village is down in the valley and the Israeli settlement is up on the hilltop. And you find if you visit the Israeli settlement that they've got water for swimming pools and to irrigate their lawns and so on. And down in the Palestinian villages really don't have water for basic uses. You know, they ration the amount of, you know, showers that they have and so on because they're short of water or it's expensive water. And though those problems, I mean, they have many causes, but the main cause of that is that the Israelis, since beginning their occupation of the West Bank in 1967, have not allowed Palestinians to sink more wells or to develop existing wells to provide more water. So the Palestinians have, in fact, because some wells have given out rather less water than they had 30 years ago, whereas the Israelis pump in water from elsewhere. And have access to the local water reserves on the West Bank and have rather more water, several times more water per head of population than the Palestinians. So that is a, you know, there's a geopolitical conflict going there, which I think is as much about water as it is about land, and certainly probably more day-to-day conflicts between the two sets of citizens on the West Bank. Probably more disputes are actually about water than even about land. You're right, most of the water, you know, there are no rivers much on the West Bank, but there is rainfall on the West Bank, and the water pours by and large down creeks and underground quite quickly, so that most of the water is tapped comes from underground. And roughly speaking, I think between two-thirds and three-quarters of the water that falls onto the West Bank region is taken by Israelis either for the settlements themselves or to be piped to parts of what I guess one might call Israel proper. So, you know, that conflict is going on. Or, I mean, many people, in fact, I'm talking about water. So that's a kind of low-level conflict over water, but a very profound one. Many people believe that the Six-Day War itself back in 1967 was also fought about war. This is about water. This is a war between Israel and its neighbors, Syria and Jordan and Egypt. And before the war, Israel was very dependent on its neighbors for getting water from the River Jordan, which is Israel's major water resource. It fills most of its taps. And by the end of the war, Israel had control of the Golan Heights, which are strategically important and were formerly in Syria, but are also the headwaters of the River Jordan. And it had control for the first time of the West Bank of the River Jordan. So suddenly, by the end of that war, Israel had control of most of the River Jordan and the land from which water into that river came. So there's a very profound change there. And Ariel Sharon, who was a general during that war, before later becoming prime minister, said in his memoirs that, in his opinion, that war was fought as much about water as about anything else. In fact, the Israelis were fearful that Syria was going to start diverting water from the River Jordan away from Israel and was going to deprive Israel of water. So it certainly wasn't, if you like, a one-sided conflict. There was a genuine issue about the future of that river. So some people would say that the first modern water war has already been fought, and it was the Six-Day War fought between Israel and its neighbors in 1967. And there's certainly other potential conflicts, particularly in the Middle East, where often water is, if not, you know, the only issue, certainly an exacerbating issue between countries.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to line number two. This is also a Champagne listener. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question on pricing, but Fred has already addressed that, so I might actually steer the questions to something else. I'm here living in Champagne, but I came from Australia. And it's an interesting story going on there. I come from Perth, and there's a big water shortage there, and the government is blaming the city people, doing all kinds of things. But the reality is that most of the water there is being used for agriculture, and then to export agriculture products to Asia and other parts of the world. So basically, what the government is doing is subsidizing farmers for their water use to export agricultural products to the rest of the world, and then blaming the local community, and then going ahead and building two desalination plants. So I'm just asking you a question: whether you have addressed the question of subsidies in your book, and also the question of desalination. A lot of places, Perth in Australia, Sydney in Australia, are already building desalination plants as a way to alleviate water shortages. But it seems to me that there are still huge subsidies being used to support other parts of the economy. So whether virtual water and better pricing of water, better valuing of water would be the way to go in solving the water crisis that you're talking about.
I think, yes, I think I agree with you. I think your analysis about what's happening in Australia and certainly around Perth is right. Subsidies are very pernicious because they you know, as a general rule, they encourage the misuse of resources of all sorts, not just water. But the case in water can be quite pernicious because there is a tradition in many, many countries of providing heavily subsidized water. And we need to get away from the idea that, as I say, that water is a free resource and instantly available and in unlimited supplies. Water is a resource like any other, and we have to treat it with care. And in our modern society, the price motive is probably the best way of doing that. So where you have heavy subsidies, you tend to have waste and misuse of resources. If now water is becoming scarce, we have to get rid of those subsidies by and large and go back to a more more economically and probably environmentally efficient system. So what you say about what is happening in Australia is absolutely right. Most of the water in Western Australia, but elsewhere in Australia, is used for agriculture. But politically, it often. But the farmers are a very, very powerful political lobby in Australia. Probably more powerful these days than they are in the U.S. And they're able to dictate terms for their supply of water, and they get the highest subsidies of all. So that the city dwellers, yes, are made to feel a little bit guilty, so that they will pay higher prices, which will probably fund, as you say, the desalination works. And you're right, Perth has plans for desalination works. Now, I mean, desalination is it's a very expensive way of getting water. Desalinating seawater, you know, it uses a lot of energy. Whatever technical system you use, whether you use filtration systems or essentially boiling the water, it takes a lot of energy and makes it rather expensive. Prices are coming down, and the Israelis probably have the best technology in the world now. That's something they're extremely good at. But even so, the prices are high. And yes, you can subsidize it, but you can't. I mean, you can. I think desalination is a realistic way, when necessary, of providing water for city taps, and sometimes for industry. It's not a cheap source, but it's plausible, and you could do it. And many cities are starting to do it. But it makes no sense at all for providing water for agriculture. You can't desalinate seawater at anything like a price that would make it, even with heavy subsidies, sensible as the basic source of water for agriculture. So, we're going to need cheaper. We're going to carry on needing cheaper sources of water for that. My view, desalination is a growing technology. It's a developing technology. It's an improving technology, and it will have a role in future. But it's not going to meet, if you like, the basic requirements. It's not going to refill our rivers because the farmers are going to carry on emptying our rivers unless we change the farming systems. We certainly can't replace river water with desalination water on the farm.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number three. This is someone in Chicago. Hello.
Thank you. Just to follow through on the comment about Australia, a number of years ago when some of the countries wanted to step in there and develop the mining potentials in Australia, the government asked, well, you're going to have to use a tremendous amount of water for your operation, and therefore they were denied the opportunity to go in and do the mining. But that makes me step over to this hemisphere and what's going on in Canada. Recently, the past week's papers pointed out that the oil that is in the tar pits and shale and all the other things has resulted in such an enormous use of water to process the removal of the oil from those shale and tar deposits. It's causing the rivers to really truly run dry. And although the water is recycled, as I said, maybe a dozen or more times, it is finally dumped out into huge ponds, and the rivers are just being drained of virtually every drop in this process. And these ponds have resulted in lakes and reservoirs that are resulting in the second largest dam in this hemisphere. as a consequence of all this polluted water. So between desalinization and decontamination, we have a huge problem of I wonder if we're going to get to the point where they're all saying water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink.
Yeah, I think what you say about what's happening in Canada is interesting. I haven't looked at it in detail, but I've certainly heard stories that very large amounts of water are being used to develop those tar sands. I think there are quite a lot of reasons why it probably doesn't make sense to develop those tar sands. It also takes very large amounts of energy to
exactly.
Remove and process process those. So you begin to whether it makes any sense that where you're using almost as much energy to get the tar out, to get the tar sands out and turn into water as you're getting from them in the first place, and when you're emptying the rivers as well. And these, of course, that region of the Midwest of Canada is an area which many climate scientists expect is going to dry out in the coming decades as well. So, and it's already under some water stress, certainly in some years. I don't think that's a kind of sensible way to go. I really don't. So I'm with you on that.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll go back here to someone in Champaign. Again, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was recently in Rome, Italy,
mm-hmm.
where the water is provided by the aqueducts.
Mm.
From Roman times, and it's the best tasting water I've ever had. Quite a contrast to the water locally that is heavily laden with chlorine.
Mm.
And I drink bottled water, but that's not it. My real question is this. I recently read some report about the way medications are contaminating our water. And this is dangerous for humans as well as many animals. In fact, there are contaminants that mm-hmm. have done away with most of the frogs all around the world, I understand. But the problem is this, that our bodies only process about 20 to 30% of the drugs we're given, mm-hmm. prescribed by our doctors, you know, for whatever ailments. The rest is excreted into the water and reprocessed, but not entirely gotten out. Is that correct?
Yes, you're right. I mean, our conventional treatment works for water are very good at removing some contaminants, and they certainly prevent bacteria and that kind of thing from getting into the tap. But there are, where do you get down to? I mean, these are very small levels, but that's not to say they're safe necessarily. Very small levels, parts per trillion, if you like, and numbers of that sort. Very tiny amounts of very, as you say, toxic chemicals that are toxic enough to be useful as pharmaceuticals. They're being excreted. Yes, they're getting into the rivers. They've been measured there, and sometimes they evade the water treatment systems and get back up the pipe so that we drink them. I share your concern. I think it's an open question exactly how much damage these toxins could do to us. But it's something which I think as kind of community we want to avoid doing. I'm not sure what the solution is. It's very difficult to try and treat drinking water, however much money you have, for the tiny amounts of lots of different toxins that may be there. Hopefully there isn't something in the system which is already causing us serious harm. But I guess at the end of the day, we don't quite know. And the trick, if there is one, is to just try and minimize these things as much as possible and to set the scientists to look for signs of trouble as early as we can.
Thank you.
Right, and drink clean water. I mean, the cleaner water you can get. Yeah, the spring water is, probably is the best stuff to drink.
Thanks for the call. Others are certainly welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Fred Pierce. He's a former news editor at New Scientist and currently serves as its environment and development consultant. He's also written for a number of other magazines. He has a book out now that deals with the issue of water around the world. The title is When the Rivers Run Dry, and the subtitle, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. It's published by the Beacon Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222. 800-945-9455. Another little interesting piece of this, something that you write about in the book, is in those places where people had primarily for a long time been depending on surface water, and where the demand and the level of use has really made surface water a scarce or maybe a non-existent resource, that what people have had to do is start to rely on groundwater, and that there, though intensive pumping of groundwater has also ended up causing problems.
Yeah, this is becoming a very big issue, I think, in Asia in particular, where, you know, the majority of the world's population now lives. I looked at this in India in particular, where I mentioned earlier these crazy units of the cubic kilometer of water, which is a hell of a lot. To give you some sense, Los Angeles needs about 1 cubic kilometer of water to survive a whole year. The whole of Los Angeles can get by on 1 cubic kilometer a year. Bear that in mind when I tell you that Indian farmers are now pumping from beneath the ground 250 cubic kilometers of water to grow their crops. And that is 100 cubic kilometers more water than is replaced by the rains. So, if you like, the underground water reserves of India, which are quite substantial, as you'll realize, are losing 100 cubic kilometers of water every year. And that means the local effect of that is that water tables are going down and down. I went to villages where a generation ago, they could bring the water from underground by simply digging a well and dropping a bucket, and 20 feet down they'd get water. No problem. Water was always there. Now it's 3/4 of a mile, even a mile down, and in some places the water is giving out altogether and people are having to give up farming because there's no other source of water. So India, in a sense, is reaching a crunch. It's part of a wider story, in a sense. I mean, I'm old enough to remember 30 years ago that everybody was worried, could the world carry on feeding a fast-growing population? We were told that in the 30 years between 1970 and today, that world population will double. How could we feed a doubled world population? Well, the truth is we did. I mean, the world population did double in that time, but the world produced twice as much food. And it did it by developing new high-yielding crop varieties that produce more food for every acre of land. The trouble is, many of those varieties turned out to be very inefficient in the way they used water. They just need large inputs, and particularly of water, to grow. And the result is that today we produce twice as much food, but we take three times as much water to do it. So India, India feeds itself better than it did 30 years ago, but it has used so much water in doing that that it's in danger, very grave danger, of running up against a real crisis of water, which will undermine its ability to feed itself. So maybe 30 years ago we thought we were going to run out of land, but now we realize that we're actually going to run out of water first. I think it's a really major problem for the world in the coming decades. It won't happen all in one day. You know, India won't run out of water one day, but bits of India will suddenly start running out of water, and farmers will carry on giving up. We'll have to give up farming, and India will reach the point where it can't feed itself, as China more or less is now, and other parts of Asia are going to follow. Vietnam, Iran, Korea, you name it, these countries are going to hit the same kind of crisis. And at that point it becomes a global crisis, because it will upset the grain markets around the world, and who knows where it will lead, but we do run the danger of water wars and wars over maybe shortages of water caused by the water shortages.
Well, if, I suppose some people would ask the question, well, if this is in some sense a problem created by technology with certain varieties that give us higher yields but need more water, what's the possibility that, again, through engineering, we could produce cultivars of the various things that we want that would actually be more efficient in their water use? And if you combine that with a more efficient way of delivering water, if you were going to irrigate, if you could do those two things together, wouldn't that at least go some way to reducing our water use without reducing yield?
I think you've got it absolutely. I mean, on a bad day, I'll get up and think, "Oh, we misuse water so badly that there's no hope for us." But on another day, I think, "Well, look, we misuse water so badly. the potential for doing it better must be so great. And there is great potential to do it better. First of all, yes, you're right, the scientists are working on the old revolution of producing the high-yield varieties they called the Green Revolution, if you remember. They're now talking about a Blue Revolution to produce high-yielding crop varieties that don't use large amounts of water. Now, there's no guarantee of success, of course. If the genes aren't there and can't be put into the crops, then it won't happen, or the plants can't be bred to develop that way, then there's a problem. But their expectation is that they will be able to do it, and that new, much more water-efficient crops will be brought online in the next few years. And as you say, there is great potential for farmers to use water much more efficiently. Most farmers around the world today still irrigate their crops by just pouring water onto the land, just flooding the land with water and expecting that some of the water will reach the roots and some will drain away and the rest will evaporate and so on. Much more efficient is to deliver the water in much smaller quantities but very close to the roots, which is called drip irrigation. Now, conventionally it's been a high-tech system, but there are being developed low-tech systems which the poorest farmer can use and greatly reduce the amount of water that they need in order to grow their crops. I think there's a great future for those technologies. That really is the way to go. So I think there are solutions. It's madness that we are emptying our rivers because we really don't need to. If we organize ourselves better, we can do it. We can think of other ways of collecting water altogether, which can be more efficient. In India, many farmers now collect the rains. Because their rains come in a great rush in the monsoon season over just 100 days in India, that traditionally people wanted to get rid of the water on their land. They regarded it as a menace, causing flooding and so on. But now they're realizing that it makes much more sense to catch the water on their land literally as it falls to the earth, often diverting it into their own wells or into small ponds so that they have water on their land to use through the year. So there are new systems like that, and that's, if you like, an alternative to relying on high-tech systems of large dams and pipe networks and so on to distribute water around the country. Many farmers, particularly in rural India, find that it makes a lot more sense to collect their own water. So it's a kind of barefoot, if you like, low-tech solution to their problems, but really rather effective. So at the end of the day, I mean, I'm actually quite optimistic. I think there really are solutions. They're technical solutions. They're solutions of just being better organized. So we can grow the crops. We can feed ourselves. We can clothe ourselves with the amount of water that we've got constantly recirculating on the planet. Water does recycle itself. It's just a matter of managing the water cycle rather better than we do now. So I'm optimistic. We can do it. It's no sort of Armageddon ahead, or at least not if we get organized.
I think here in the United States, and I think also in the UK, when it comes to water use, we have this principle that says if you have property and there's water on it or water runs by it, you have the right to use some of that water at a reasonable amount. The problem is, though, that who decides, and if someone's complaining about somebody else using too much water, then I think the only alternative is to end up going to court over the issue. Some people, I think, would say it would be a better thing if governmental units all kind of got together and said, look, this is a common resource. It's important to all of us. We need to manage this in a responsible way, and we're going to all sit down together and decide how to do that. Well, I don't know that that has happened very much in the past. Some say we're definitely going to have to start doing that in the future. What possibility is there that perhaps on some sort of a large scale, either regional or perhaps between countries, that they're going to get together instead of fighting over it, they're going to get together and say, look, this is an important common resource, and we have to manage it to the maximum benefit for everybody in a sustainable way. Any possibility that that actually would happen?
Well, I think it's going to have to. I mean, some people talk about water wars. Some people actually say, well, water actually could be a catalyst for peace because it's just so important that people will just have to negotiate over it and have to reach agreement about it. Large rivers are, I guess, a particular point where the water is not even static. It doesn't even really come with the land. It's just flowing down the river to the sea. And there's a huge need, but also a huge potential for developing treaties to share out that water in an equitable way, and that really has to happen. Many rivers around the world today don't have treaties. They really do need them. The World Bank is doing quite good work here. In fact, it says that it won't fund large dams or other water infrastructure projects
on large international rivers that don't have treaties. So it pushes the agenda for treaties the whole time. That makes obvious sense. But we do need, I think we need similar agreements about how we manage underground water reserves. There is a long tradition in the U.S. that with the land comes the water beneath it. But you don't necessarily need to throw that away. If you have a market in water, perhaps today many people believe that too much of American water is used for farming when there are other needs for industry and often for cities to use water. So many cities land up desalinating seawater because they don't have access to other water in the area around because it's all taken by farmers. But you can imagine a system where you have much more effective water marketing where the farmers simply sell the water on to the cities and make a profit that way. If you like, they harvest the water rather than anything else on their land. The system now we have is a little different. Out in Arizona and elsewhere in the West, there's many cities that simply routinely buy up farmland, not because they want the land, but because they want the water beneath. Now, that doesn't sound, I mean, it's a way out of the problem for the cities, but it doesn't strike me as the most sensible solution. So maybe we have to rethink some of these issues, revisit some of these questions. But they're quite difficult. You know, this has to do with sort of the basic law of the frontier going back a long way, and people often don't want to give that up.
Yeah.
But we certainly have to find a way through it one way or another, whether we change those rules about water and land or whether we accept that they're going to stay and open up the market so that the market can resolve some of the problems.
There we must stop. The book that we're talking about here, if you'd like to read it, is When the Rivers Run Dry, published by the Beacon Press by our guest Fred Pierce. He's a former news editor and news scientist and now serves as its environment and development consultant. Mr. Pierce, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Can I just correct one statistic?
Oh, yes,
I told you
yes.
Earlier that in a day I use the amount of water equivalent to the weight of my own body. I was misquoting. The real figure is 100 times the weight of my own body.
Considerably
more.
The
amount of water I used in a day.
All right. Well, again, thanks very much for your time.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.